BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Good evening. We're broadcasting from our Queen Square studio in the heart of Bristol. Our guest tonight is Mark Sumner, who worked in Iraq in 2003. He's going to talk about his experiences over there. There's the second part of Tony Gosling's History of the Theatre in Bristol, and myself, Lisa Braden and Anthea Page, report from the Hay on Wye Literary Festival. Malcolm Greaves reads the first extract of Sided with Rosie by Laurie Lee, and Jeff is here with his What's On guide. Now it's over to John Peters Coleman for the news.
Ministry of Defence have just released previously top-secret and even above-top-secret reports of UFO sightings covering the period 1978 to 1987, including reports of sightings by West Country locals in Barnstable, Biddeford, Newton Tracy and elsewhere nearby. A large number of requests for information under the Freedom of Information Act have led the MOD to release a limited amount of information, with the rest covering the period 1988 to 2002 being released over the next 3 years. The files began being kept by the MOD during the Cold War, when government interest in UFO reports was due to their concern over Soviet military aircraft entering UK airspace. David Clark, an expert in UFO history, who helped research the files for the National Archives, recorded a podcast that accompanied the release. Once the chance of a sighting being a Soviet military aircraft had been ruled out, quote, "they weren't interested in it any further," Clark said, who went on saying, "There's no evidence that any of these contact reports or sightings of aliens were followed up by the Ministry of Defence," thus making the idea of a massive cover-up somewhat unlikely. However, the reports make curious reading. A World War II veteran reported having a lucky escape from alien abduction whilst fishing in the southern town of Aldershot. In a 1983 report titled The Close Encounter Case, the angler described a vivid light that came towards him. Two forms, about 4 feet tall, approached him, quote, "dressed in pale green coveralls from head to foot and helmets of the same colour with a visor that was blacked out. The man followed the little green creatures to their ship into an octagonal black room. Quote, all of a sudden, a voice said to me, 'Come and stand under the amber light,' he reported. The space traveller let the man go after asking his age. At almost 78, he was told that he was, quote, too old and too infirm for our purpose. On one especially dramatic night in May 1985, RAF Chivna in Devon received an unusual number of reports of apparent UFO sightings. Between 11 p.m. and midnight on Tuesday, May the 28th, unexplainable lights baffled locals. The most detailed report spoke of an object the size of a Sea King helicopter and a set of lights in what appeared to be a racetrack pattern. The witness, an RAF corporal no less, saw two sets of lights extremely close together and described their formation as better than that of the Red Arrows. In a 1983 note, the Ministry said explanations for reports of strange things in the sky included satellite debris re-entering the atmosphere, lightning, unusual cloud formations, meteorological balloons and aircraft lights. The Ministry said, quote, it certainly has no evidence that alien spacecraft have landed on this planet. Having said that, the accounts seem often to come from unexpectedly respectable people. Even the unshakable Winston Churchill himself, after a series of UFO scares during the early 50s, wrote a panicky memo to his advisers, writing, what does all this stuff about flying saucers amount to? What can it mean? What is the truth? To find out more, check out http://ufos.nationalarchives.gov.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
you, John Peters Coleman there. Coming up now is a track from Beth Rowley's new record called In the Beautiful Tomorrow.
In the beautiful tomorrow, so much sweeter than today. In the beautiful tomorrow, where tears will pass away. There'll be no heartache and no pain. In the beautiful tomorrow, oh, so much sweeter than today. In the beautiful tomorrow, so much sweeter than today.
So much sweeter than today. In the beautiful tomorrow, where tears will pass away, there'll be no dark clouds to block my gaze. In the beautiful tomorrow, oh, oh, so much sweeter than today.
That was Beth Rowley. With food prices rising rapidly, it seems the old days of cheap supermarket grub are over. It's getting more and more expensive to import food, what with oil prices going through the rooftop. So if necessary, could we grow all our own food in Britain cheaply? That's the question editor of The Land magazine, Simon Fairley, has been asking. And to follow on from last week's report on the planning bill this week, he looks at whether we have to import nearly half the food we eat in Britain.
Can Britain feed itself is an important issue because food security is something like that is likely to rise on the agenda over the next two decades. At the moment, we import 40% of our food, and because of that, the government is fairly blasé about it and thinks that we don't really need to worry about whether we can produce all our food or not. But over the next 20 years, whether the world becomes richer or whether it becomes poorer, we are going to find it harder to import food, I think. If the world becomes poorer, that means that less food will be grown and it will become more expensive. And if the world becomes richer, that means more and more people in China and India and in the third world are going to be eating meat, which will they will be demanding more grain for the meat. And that will put the price of food up. And in fact, we've seen it in the last year. The price of wheat has doubled. And that is already engendering a change of attitude towards agriculture. Now, what we've done in Can Britain Feed Itself is to look and see, firstly, whether there's enough land to produce all the food that we need in England, which there is, there's no doubt about that, but also to compare different ways of producing food and see which uses the most land and which uses the least. We've compared chemical agriculture, organic agriculture, permaculture and vegan systems, and the results are a little too complex to put in a nutshell, but it makes very interesting reading.
Now, most people know that actually growing food is much more efficient than having livestock if you're talking about what the kind of calorific value is at the end of the day. So have you looked at that?
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of comparisons on that. It does depend on whether it's chemical livestock or it's organic, because you see, chemical production requires less land because you're getting a lot of the nitrogen from fossil fuels, which of course has a lot of problems in terms of global warming.
You mean fertilizers? Do they come from fossil fuels as well?
Yes. Well, nitrogen is extracted from the atmosphere, and chemical agriculture extracts it by burning coal or gas or whatever, quite expensively. To obtain a kind of instant nitrogen fix. Livestock organic, it gets nitrogen from the atmosphere by plants, particularly clover, absorb it from the atmosphere, then the animals eat the plants, and then their manure goes to produce the nitrogen. Vegan agriculture skips out the livestock bit and simply plants clover or loose alfalfa or something like that, and that brings in the nitrogen to the soil. Now, we've compared all these various systems. If you compare vegan organic with livestock organic, you do not see a big difference in the amount of land take for arable, i.e. for growing crops, because the vegan system has to rely on green manure to bring in nitrogen, exactly the same as organic, but the organic people put it through a cow first and get a bit of milk out of it as well. The big difference in land take between vegan and animal is that the livestock people will use a lot more of grassland and other lands which are not used for arable for feeding cows and sheep and so forth, whereas the vegans will not use grazing animals and therefore will have this land which they really need to find another use for, whether it be for wood production or biomass production or just wildlife or whatever. I think one of the main conclusions we can take is that if we are going to go organic, which I hope we are, then we need to make a decision between what we do with the land which is not arable. The price of wheat has more than doubled in the last few months, and that is having a knock-on effect on the price of all sorts of products. What will happen in the future? Who knows? But it's entirely possible with things like global warming, with increases of population and so forth, that and with the pressure on for biofuel crops as well, all these factors can push up the price of food enormously, and it wouldn't take a lot for Britain to suddenly find that actually agriculture was a very sensible and profitable use of land and would save a lot of money, and that buying imports from other countries would be quite expensive.
Simon Farley there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling and explaining some of the different types of agricultural systems by which Britain could actually feed itself. And you can subscribe to Simon's magazine, The Land, on the web at www.telio.org.uk/chapter7 or phone him on 01460 249 204.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
In the studio with us now is Mark Sumner, who worked for a civil engineering company in Iraq during the period September 2003 to February 2004. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi. So you worked for a company called Halcro. What did they do in Iraq?
They were awarded a contract to renovate buildings that had been dilapidated, looted, or in rare cases, destroyed during the war, including hospitals, university, agricultural ministry buildings, all kind of standard stuff that we take for granted. They had no infrastructure at all, so it's almost a starting from scratch.
So had you had any experience of working in war-torn countries before you went or abroad at all?
Not at all, no, never worked abroad. I just worked in the IT department. I'm not a civil engineer, I work in IT. And they'd also got a contract to renovate three buildings in three provinces north of Basra for the interim government to operate out of, and my remit was to design, procure and install this IT infrastructure for civilian and army allied personnel to function and run the local government.
Right. And what were your opinions of the war? Were you sort of pro, anti, indifferent?
Prior to the war, I was anti. I didn't think it was a good idea. I never really do. After the war, I think we were duty bound to stay and help rebuild, having walked in there and caused so much carnage. I also discovered while I was there that the South was hugely dilapidated, and most of that had come about from the fact that the First War, the people in the south, the Shias in Basra especially, had risen up against Saddam. And then we and the Americans had left and gone home, and Saddam took it out on the Shias. He never forgave them. There was no investment, and the place was shocking. Really was. It was like a different world.
What were your feelings? I mean, the company suggested that you go and work in Iraq. What were your first feelings about that?
Well, I was apprehensive, but I've got a bit of a spirit of adventure, and I wanted to see for myself what was going on. And after an experience like that, you realise when you watch the news what a small soundbite it is, and how often the bigger picture is completely missed or just glossed over. So it was a fantastic experience for me to be there and experience this firsthand. Saddam was being caught and all that sort of thing, and the joy that brought to the locals. I didn't do it for the money, certainly.
So were you in contact with the various armies that worked there?
Yes. In Basra, we stayed in a hotel. But the provinces I was looking after, which were the provincial towns, were Amara, Nasiriyah, and Samawa. Each of those was managed and controlled by a different military unit. The British were in Amara, Italians in Nasiriyah, and to the west in Samawa was the Dutch. So I stayed with all these people, and I've experienced the different military regimes and how they operate, and their rules and regulations and how they conduct themselves. And that was a very eye-opening experience as well.
So what were they like? What were the difference between them that you noticed?
Well, the British, as you'd expect, well-organised, very well-maintained, heavily disciplined. They couldn't go firing the guns willy-nilly. Any discharge of any weapon had to be accounted for, which is completely different to the American outlook, where you often see them in the desert taking pot shots at camels. The Dutch were similar again. They were a decent, friendly bunch of people. They were well organized. They seemed well drilled, and they went about their job with good humor and a smile on their faces. The Italians, I think they tried to a certain extent, but I didn't feel they were really cut out for the military experience. They only did a 3-month tour, whereas everyone else did 6. And there are a couple of examples that people told me about where they failed to assist the situation and made matters worse. For instance, there was a situation where a local petrol station owner had hired essentially some security guards to look after his highly sought-after commodity. Mm-hmm. Now, there were a lot of guns in Iraq, and permits were bought in to try and regulate and control who had access to what. And the Italian army came along to this petrol station and found this man had armed guards, but he didn't have the permits for them. Now, a similar situation happened with the Brits, and what they did was they organized the permits within a couple of days, and they let the guards carry on in the meantime, and all was well. But the Italians just came along and said, no permits, no guns, you're going to have to leave. They made all the guards go off, unemployed essentially, find some more work elsewhere. And within a few weeks, bandits had come and they'd done the place over, stolen all the petrol. And I don't know what happened to the owner, but he wasn't done any favours by the Italian armies. There's also stories of the marshes, which needed to be reflooded. They were drained by Saddam because he didn't like the marsh Arabs, so he drained the marshes into big canals. So the plan was to reflood the marshes and give the people back their homelands where they'd sort of fish and grow appropriate crops. Now, some of the farmers had during this time of draining the marshes, had dammed up certain areas so that should reflooding ever occur, their land would not be flooded as it had been previously, so they could grow wheat and essentially make more money. Yeah. And they had also employed some guards to come and look after their land. Now, when the water was going to be re-let in, or they were going to re-flood the marshes, the Italians were told to come and take this dam down, essentially an illegal dam, because it would divert water to a nearby village, and that was unacceptable. But this man said no, and he threatened the Italian army with his armed guards, who, rather than take a diplomatic approach and deal with this, as they should have been trained, wrote a letter of complaint to the ministry in Baghdad, which got lost in a pile of bureaucracy, I believe. The river was reflooded, and the village was flooded because these dams were still in place. And they just seemed totally ineffectual. Though the food was good and they made nice coffee.
A small consolation. Given that the technique of the local Iraqis who are fighting against the armies is obviously not to wear uniforms, how did you feel when you came into contact with locals? How did you tell friend from foe? Was it quite a sort of a paranoid experience, or were they quite sort of friendly?
On the most part, they were friendly. I didn't go walking the streets. I was either in a hotel in Basra, or the three provinces were essentially a military compound and we were guarded. However, at all times we tried to employ local people where we could rather than bringing in external contractors. So I met a lot of locals, and they all seemed happy to see us, and they knew why we were there, and they were pleased for our help, and they were happy to be rid of Saddam. But there were some shouts, and you could hear out in the street, and you could see people sort of waving and shaking your fists, but we didn't hang about between places. I always had a sort of an armed or four armed guards for most of the time. We would travel in a couple of vehicles, and you just go from A to B. You don't hang around. There's not a lot of time for small talk with the locals. But the friendly ones that we essentially employed were fantastic, really. Lovely people.
When you eventually decided that you did want to leave, or come to think of it, when you first joined up, and what was the pastoral care of the employees by the company like that you worked for? How did they handle you being at risk?
Well, it wasn't. It was certainly voluntary. They didn't make me go. They put out a request, which I volunteered for. We had some special training. We had some warfare type training where some experts came in, explained all the situation about what happens with different types of wounding you can get from mortars to being shot, and what to do with emergency first aid, that sort of thing. And they supplied us with, I had a helmet and sort of full body armor. I never really wore the helmet, to be honest, but the body armor saw a lot of action. I wore it a lot. I didn't get shot and hit. So they I wouldn't say they paid brilliantly, but I was recompensed, and they gave us some sort of a daily allowance, which really I couldn't spend because there was nowhere to go apart from the odd American airbase. I've no complaints about the way the company looked after us. But if I was in it for the money, I wouldn't have gone.
Right. I mean, what were your fellow employees like? How did they handle being in a foreign country?
Well, they were civil engineers, so they were used to it. That's what they do. However, not normally in a war zone. Though one of them had spent many years in Eritrea, where there's been a lot of sort of civil war, and the Sudan is nearby. And he just, I guess I learned a lot from him, because it was just water off the duck's back to them. There's not a lot, once you're there, there's nothing you can do about it. So as long as you can find somewhere to get some beers from, then, you're probably going to be okay.
Okay. Did anything sort of tragic happen at all, or were there any near misses?
Yes, there were a couple of near misses. We were shot at from time to time. There were a few mortar incidents, though mortars are notoriously inaccurate, especially when they're normally handheld. If you think just standing holding a tube with it's got a rocket in it, but if you're going to try and sort of point that, and it's going to go up and come down and exactly where you want it to land, it's not very likely. They're not accurate. Though one did go through the roof, a corrugated roof of a sort of caravan, porter cabin type structure, through the roof of what essentially was the bathroom, and embedded itself in the wall of a shower, which was discovered by someone the next morning as he opened the bathroom door, much to his shock. The reason it hadn't detonated is there's a plunger on the front of these mortars, and the just corrugated porter cabin was so thin, it had just gone straight through and embedded itself in the polystyrene that forms the sort of layers between the two you know, the two thin walls. So it just sort of embedded there and not detonated. I think that's the closest I came to anything. You know, I saw the thing. I heard a few whistles of mortars here and there, but it's not, it's sort of, it's all quite distant. There was always the cackle of gunfire, always, at all times, but it's the norm out there. They've all got guns and they all like shooting them in the air, and just because you hear gunfire, it doesn't necessarily mean they're shooting each other or they're shooting at you. So it just became ambient noise after a while, and you do get used to it.
How did you feel that your opinions about the war and what we have done in Iraq changed at all during your time there, and how do you feel about it now?
Well, as I said, prior to going out there, I wasn't keen on the war at all. However, the Shias, especially in the south, were severely oppressed, heavily oppressed. And that really, in a way, is our fault for kind of leading them to uprising in the first Gulf War 10 years previously, and then walking out on them as they did that. And Saddam didn't forgive them. But I didn't think going back into war's never a good idea, and I didn't think going back in was a good idea, and I didn't like the way it was handled by the government or any of that. But once we were there and the job was done, I didn't feel we could walk away. You know, we had a commitment to these people to help them help themselves, essentially, and, you know, and do what we can.
Well, the question that everybody's probably going to ask eventually, would you do it again?
Would I go back to Iraq now? No chance, no. I left on the 20th of February 2004. I could have stayed for longer, but I'd accomplished what I wanted to accomplish, and I was essentially just sort of supporting the environment, which KBR, the Halliburton subsidiary, was supposed to do, but they were having personnel issues. And I felt I was pushing my luck by staying any longer, and so I went home then, and a few weeks after, I think it was about in the middle of March of that year that the kidnappings really started in earnest. So I got out in the nick of time and I won't be going back.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking about experiences, Mark Sumner, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hay on Wye in Herefordshire celebrated its 24th literary festival this year. Hay as a town has more books per square mile than any other place in England and is renowned all over the world as a literary centre. The mystical site of its creator, Richard Booth, is still possible even on festival days, although he does tend to retire from public gaze in the evenings. I was there with Dialect's intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, to find out more about the festival and interview Celia Boyd and Marion Keyes, two of the authors present at the festival.
Paperback writer. You sat all night, will you read my book? It took me years to write, will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer.
Hello, I'm in the main library at the castle in Hay-on-Wye at the Literary Festival, and I'm about to talk to a very interesting lady. Hello.
Hello. My name's Celia Boyd, and I'm the author of a series called A Reason from the Stars, which is set in the English Civil War and which has as its main character a surgeon called Tom Fletcher.
Now, is this based on fiction, this character, or did he actually exist?
He actually did exist. There is, he is mentioned in Essex lists of the army, the Parliamentarian army that went to Edge Hill, the Battle of Edge Hill in 1642. And in Basil Lord Fielding's regiment, a surgeon, Thomas Fletcher, is named.
All right. How did you get into this interest in the Civil War, and this person in particular?
Well, I was writing short stories on the English Civil War for my own enjoyment, or I don't know what. I was idly looking through these lists of Essex soldiers, the parliamentarians, and I saw this name, Thomas Fletcher, and suddenly a voice, which this sounds really bizarre, but it really happened, a voice said, "Once, whilst committing suicide, I changed my mind." And that is the first line of the first book, which is called First Dry Rattle. The title comes from Rudyard Kipling's poem, Edgehill Fight, and the full quotation is, "The first dry rattle of new-drawn steel changes the world today." That's the sound of the swords altogether rattling out of the scabbards, change the face of England forever. And it was the battle, the first battle, which caused the English Civil War to get underway, and it caused the beginnings of democracy, or rather caused democracy to continue, as it were.
Right, and how many books have you actually written?
I've written two, and I've almost written the third.
On the Civil War?
Yes.
And do you intend writing more about it?
Or? Yes, I should think there'll be about 10 by the time unless I die first.
Oh, and will it cover the whole of the Civil War?
Yes, I think it will. The last one will probably be the one in which Tom Fletcher goes to Barbados, where, as a bondsman, because he was mistaken for Charles II. He looked like Charles II.
Oh, yeah.
And there will be a moment after the Battle of Worcester in 1651 when the parliamentarian troops think they've caught the king, which they haven't. I mean, that is stretching history very slightly. Okay.
And where do you get, like, the actual facts to write the book from? Do you do a lot of research?
Yes, I do, mainly from books on the Civil War. And we have got a number of books, critical works, historical works on the Civil War, and many very factual ones too, because it was quite well documented. But there is very little fiction, apart from The Children of the New Forest. There's very little. Oh, and a lady called Pamela Bell. She writes romances. They're very good, set in the English Civil War. But apart from that, I think I may be unique. I don't know. You can't may be unique. You either are or you aren't. But I think that I've. I don't know of anyone else anyway at the moment.
So these books, are they stored in the Public Record Office or the British Library? Where's the main source for these?
Amazon. Any historian that's written on the Civil War, of course, you can get it from Amazon.
Oh, right. So, once again, could you just tell our listeners the name of the book where they can find them if they'd like to read them and purchase them?
The names of the book so far are First Dry Rattle, that's the first one, and A Daring Resolution. That was a phrase that applied to Prince Rupert. The second book is largely set in Lichfield.
Oh, yeah.
And Prince Rupert was our first terrorist. He set the first landmine in Britain and blew up the close of Lichfield, the wall of the close anyway. Today he would never be allowed on public transport.
Especially with a rucksack.
Yes, especially with a rucksack full of grenades.
Where can they buy these books?
From Pemberton's in Hay-on-Wye or Amazon. I'm on Amazon as Celia Boyd.
Okay.
First Dry Rattle, A Daring Resolution.
Okay, thank you very much.
I slip a little leather wing bat to tell to you the reason that I fly by night. It's because I lost my heart's delight. Howdy dowdy diddle o' day. Howdy dowdy diddle o' day. Howdy dowdy diddle o' day. Hey, diddle lay low. I
I'm with Marion Keyes at the Hay on Wye Festival, and she's here to promote her new book, This Charming Man. Marion, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
A few quick questions. What's going to be your next project?
I've started another book. Other than that, you know, that's all I like doing. I like writing books. Is that the kind of answer?
That's wonderful, yeah. Thank you. Is there another burning social issue that you feel passionate about that you're going to write about next, or is, you don't know yet?
Yeah, no, I do know. I mean, it's connected, I suppose, to the issue of domestic violence, which I've written about in This Charming Man, and it's the issue of rape and how we as a society treat rape, how the victim of the crime becomes like the
scum of the earth.
Well, the person who committed the crime, you know, it we've such a peculiar way of approaching it as a society, and the conviction rates are very, very low, like abnormally low. It's only 6%, and I really find it hard to believe that 94 of every case of rape that's brought to the courts is a vexatious one. So yeah, that's what I'm hoping to address.
Right, on that issue, I was there last year, unfortunately, in November, and the way I was treated by the police was despicable. I was made to feel like it's all my fault, and I was actually informed by a male police officer with a female present, with her head bowed. She didn't speak to me, and he said, oh, we're not pursuing this, rah, 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 rah. And it's all, I said, what about this, what about that? And he just said, well, that's all circumstantial. And I was mugged as well. He goes, oh, well, you've been drinking, it was your fault. And you're absolutely right that they're terrible the way people are treated, but I'm very pleased that you are addressing it. Would you ever write a book from a man's perspective?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think I would be able to. No. I mean, I think it's very important to try and stretch myself as a writer, but it's also important to acknowledge my limitations, and I just don't think I would be able to do it justice. So no, I don't think so.
Okay, and finally, I do appreciate you taking time.
Not at all.
Have you got a favourite book that you've written and why?
Have one. Like, people often ask that, but I think it would be like asking a mother to pick a favourite child. I just couldn't. You know, I'm proud of them all.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's an inspiration to meet you, and thank you very, very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
And it's a wonderful present for me. Thank you
thank
very much.
Thank you. Thanks a million.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
What a great day. Now we have Malcolm Grieve in the studio. Malcolm is a regular performer on Dialect Radio, and he's going to read the first extract from Sided with Rosie.
Sided with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Chapter 1. First Light. I was set down from the carrier's cart at the age of 3. And there, with a sense of bewilderment and terror, my life in the village began. The June grass amongst which I stood was taller than I was, and I wept. I'd never been so close to grass before. It towered above me and all around me, each blade tattooed with tiger skins of sunlight. It was knife-edged, dark, and a wicked green, thick as a forest and alive with grasshoppers that jerked and chattered and leapt through the air like monkeys. I was lost, and didn't know where to move. A tropic heat oozed up from the ground, rank with sharp odours of roots and nettles. Snow clouds of elder blossom banked in the sky, showering upon me the fumes and flakes of their sweet and giddy suffocation. High overhead ran frenzied larks, screaming as though the sky were tearing apart. For the first time in my life, I was out of the sight of humans. For the first time in my life, I was alone in a world whose behaviour I could neither predict nor fathom. A world of birds that squealed, of plants that stank, of insects that sprang about without warning. I was lost, and I did not expect to be found again. I put back my head and howled, and the sun hit me smartly on the face, like a bully. From this daylight nightmare I was awakened, as for many another, by the appearance of my sisters. They came scrambling and calling up the steep, rough bank, and parting the long grass, found me. Faces of rose, familiar, living. Huge, shining faces hung up like shields between me and the sky. Faces with grins and white teeth, some broken. To be conjured up like genii with a howl, brushing off terror with their broad scoldings and affection. They leaned over me, one, two, three, their mouths smeared with red currants and their hands dripping with juice. There, there, it's all right, don't you wail any more. Come down home and we'll stuff you with currants. And Marjorie the eldest lifted me into her long brown hair and ran me jogging down the path and through the steep rose-filled garden and set me down on the cottage doorstep, which was our home, though I couldn't believe it. That was the day we first came to the village, in the summer of the last year of the First World War, to a cottage that stood in half an acre of garden on a steep bank above a lake, a cottage with three floors and a cellar, and a treasure in the walls, with a pump and apple trees, syringa and strawberries, rooks in the chimneys, frogs in the cellar, mushrooms on the ceiling, and all for 3 and 6 pence a week. I don't know where I lived before then. My life began on the carrier's cart, which brought me up the long, slow hills to the village, and dumped me in the long grass and lost me. I had ridden wrapped up in a Union Jack to protect me from the sun, and when I rolled out of it and stood piping loud among the buzzing jungle of that summer bank, then I feel as I born. And to all the rest of us, the whole family of eight, it was the beginning of a life. But on that first day, we were all lost. Chaos was coming, cartloads of furniture, and I crawled the kitchen floor through forests of upturned chair legs and crystal fields of glass. We were washed up in a new land, and began to spread out, searching for its springs and treasures. The sisters spent the light of that first day stripping the fruit bushes in the garden. The currants were at their prime, clusters of red, black, and yellow berries, all tangled up with wild roses. Here was bounty the girls had never known before, and they darted squawking from bush to bush, clawing the fruit like sparrows. Our mother, too, was distracted from duty, seduced by the rich wilderness of the garden so long abandoned. All day she trotted to and fro, flushed and garrulous, pouring flowers into every pot and jug she could find on the kitchen floor. Flowers from the garden, daisies from the bank, cow parsley, grasses, ferns and leaves, they flowed in armfuls through the cottage door until its dim interior seemed entirely possessed by the world outside. A still green pool flooded with honeyed tides of summer. I sat on the floor on a raft of muddles and gazed through the green window, which was full of the rising garden. I saw the long black stockings of the girls, gaping with white flesh, kicking amongst the currant bushes. Every so often, one of them would dart into the kitchen, cram my great mouth with handfuls of squashed berries, and run out again. And the more I got, the more I called for more. It was like feeding a fat young cuckoo.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now for the second instalment of Tony Gosling's feature on the history of Bristol Theatre.
The story of the Bristol stage from 1490 to 1925. Serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 2, Bristol's First Shakespeare. In 1704, Mr. Power opened a theatrical booth in Tucker Street, Bristol Bridge, by the 14 Stars, a beautiful old inn of the Elizabethan period, built in 4 storeys.
Mr. Power and some of the actors in this company were alleged to be men of evil habits, and it seems as if there was truth in their judgment. It was also said that Power produced plays of low morale. The Provoked Wife was one of the plays. Congreve's play Love for Love was especially censured, but it is amusing to find this very play was produced a few years later in the same city, and that it was then highly applauded. It is even more entertaining to note that the censorious objected strongly to a play containing blasphemous messages. It was called Macbeth by one William Shakespeare. The Common Council requested the mayor and aldermen to send the players outside the city boundaries because of this lewdness and debauchery. Apparently their request was ignored. Again, we read a little later that in July at the next quarter sessions, the judges appealed to for the expulsion of the players. So, in the year 1705, Power's Theatre was closed to the public for theatrical performances and converted into a chapel for the Presbyterians. This kind of procedure was terrible for the actors, who were men of no settled means, who lived from hand to mouth. It did not so much affect the authors of the plays, who were often men of fashion. Power must have been a determined person, for he opened another theatre in Bristol immediately, probably in St. Augustine's Place. He commenced his season with Timon of Athens. Once more, the Puritan faction appealed to the grand jury on August the 10th, 1706. Their appeal was apparently disregarded, for we find them again at the next Grand Assizes. This appeal resulted in the suspension of Mr. Power and his company. We do not hear of him again. St. Augustine's Palace Theatre was converted into Lady Huntingdon's Salem Chapel. The Society for the Reformation of Manners, with its Puritan friends, having won the day, Bristol was left without a theatre. A company of very inferior strolling players opened a small theatre in Bristol in 1723. We do not know what happened to them afterwards, but they were artistically of no importance. A fresh company of players came to Bristol in 1726. They began with Addison's Cato. Their season ran from June to August, the three summer months when the London stage was closed. The same company is recorded as playing the Beggar's Opera at the Great Booth in Bridewell Lane, near St. James, in 1728. The Beggar's Opera had a tremendous run all over the country, and Mr. Hippisley, who was the original Peacham, was the leading comedian of this company of players in Bristol. Mr. Macklin, afterwards a celebrated actor of the Bristol Company, probably came to this city with Hippisley. The Puritans appealed under the company to the grand jury, but no proceedings were taken against them. For one reason, they were far too popular in Bristol. The majority of the citizens were on their side. Evidently the company was doing well, for soon they enlarged their ambitions and planned to build another and permanent theatre as a home for the legitimate drama. 18 people each subscribed £300. Hippisley himself constructed the theatre, and the premises were vested in him as lessee and manager. He paid a rent of £41 a year, and his daughter, who succeeded him, continued to pay this. The London Weekly Journal for June the 28th, 1929, published this report. "We are now building a very spacious theatre at Lime Kilns, lying convenient for coaches, as well as for the rope walk leading to the Hot Wells. We hear they intend to open on Monday next with the comedy of Love for Love." On June the 23rd, Hippisley and his company took up their residence in the new home, the theatre in Jacob's Wells. In spite of all the money spent on its structure, Chatterton speaks of this theatre as a hut at Jacob's Wells. This little playhouse was built half a mile away from the city, out into the country. The way from the Queen's Square up the rope walk and dark lanes was rather over-exciting and sometimes really dangerous. The theatre was built under Brandon Hill, next to the celebrated Malt Shovel, where the company foregathered, making an impromptu club room where they met theatre-loving Bristolians. The little theatre was strangely built. To pass from the P to the OP side, when the theatre was full, actors had to go out of the house altogether. This gave great delight to the public, who gathered on Brandon Hill to see them. The cause of this curious arrangement was that the amphitheatre was built up behind the stage. If the house was full and the amphitheatre was required, there could also be no scenery. The theatre was nearly always packed to overflowing, so the scenery was eliminated. The effect must have been very curious to English eyes. The actors and the audience were one, as in Oriental theatres. This must have been fruitful of strange dramatic effects. During intervals, the audience wandered on the paths and green slopes of Brandon Hill, a most pleasant interlude. To the top gallery, servants of the quality were admitted free. They proved sorry gods indeed. The company planned this arrangement, hoping for applause in return, but they often received instead abuse, and even rotten oranges or apples, and the custom became the greatest nuisance of the theatre. The prices of admission were boxes, 3 shillings, pit, 2 shillings, balcony and pigeonholes, 1 and 6, and gallery, 1 shilling. The pigeonholes were scats above the proscenium. Hippisley had joined Rich's company at Lincoln's Inn Fields in 1722, and he was afterwards at Drury Lane. In his youth, he'd been burnt on the cheek, and this added greatly to his comic appearance. The great Quin was a good friend to Hippisley. Quin advised Hippisley about his son. "Burn his face," he said, "and make him an actor." Davis wrote of him, "Hippisley was a comedian of lively humour and droll pleasantry. He had genius and was a true artist in his own line of business." Hippisley was also a dramatist. He produced his play Flora, an adaptation of Cibber's Hob in the Wall. He also wrote an interlude which was known as Hippisley's Drunken Man. Another of his productions was a farce which he called A Journey to Bristol, or The Honest Welshman. Macklin was famous as Shylock at Drury Lane. He joined the Bristol Company in 1741. On June the 15th, 1743, the company produced The Conscious Lovers, The Old Man Taught Wisdom, and The Virgin Unmasked. We read of another theatre opened in Stokes Croft in 1744. It apparently was a variety house with performances of melodrama interspersed. On April the 2nd, a tragedy was enacted at this house called Virtue Betrayed, or Anna Bullen. This must have been spectacular, for the description is, "In which will be introduced the grand procession of the coronation of Anna Bullen, as performed in London with all the peers and peeresses, knights of the garter, knights of the bath, bishops, kings, and heralds-at-arms, etc., in proper robes and dresses. Mr. Marshall was Henry VIII, and a child of 6 took the part of the Princess Elizabeth." Hippisley died on February the 12th, 1748. An amusing play has come down to us, which proved how Shakespeare was loved in the days of our primitive theatres. A young wife insisted on attending a performance of Romeo and Juliet, in spite of the entreaties of her relations. She had her desire, but had to leave the theatre before the play was over, and on her way home, as she crossed over Brandon Hill, she gave birth to a boy. She called him Romeo. That was part two of the history of the Bristol stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. And next week, part three, the Jacobs Wells Theatre Riot. Now then, we have this week's Bristol Region Alternative Theatre listings from Prompt magazine. From the 12th to the 14th of June, Blood and War. St. Paul's Players, Backwell Playhouse at 7:30. For tickets, call 0117 982 6020. From the 12th to the 14th, Caught in the Net by Ray Cooney, The Court Players, Memorial Hall, Rangeworthy at 7:30. That's 01454 321 149. And A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare is coming up, performed by the Actonians, outdoor production at the Parish Hall Grounds, Iron Acton. That's from the 19th to the 21st of June. Call 01454 776 779. The Avon Association of Drama covers the Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas. It publishes Prompt magazine 10 times a year. Other activities include festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year, and the Avon Association of Drama's website is at www.avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is subscription secretary on 01454 238 384.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 13th of June, and at the Invention Studios in Bath, the John E. Vistick Experience will be performing with Emily Breeze and the Hinkley Vale Tones. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 and £4 for concessions. Also on the 13th of June and at the Bunch of Grapes in Bristol, Grip Shift will be performing. The gig should start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Moving on to Song of the Week, and tonight I will be paying tribute to Bo Diddley, who passed away on June the 2nd this year, aged 79. The song was written in 1956 and is titled Who Do You Love?
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? 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 Tombstone hand and a graveyard mind, just 22 and I don't mind dying. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Town, use a rattlesnake whip. Take it easy, Arlie, don't give me no lip. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
That was Bo Diddley with Who Do You Love? For more information on him, you can check out www.bo-diddley.com. Moving on to Saturday, 14th of June, and at Henry Street in Totterdown, Bristol, they'll be having a free two-day music fest. Some of the acts confirmed are the Glitzy Bag Hags, The Exhibition, Chris Scott's Blues Devils, The Hit Ups, and Clumsy. Also on 14th of June and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, the ska group Imperials are performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, on 15th of June, Steve Payne will be launching his new CD, No Commercial Value, at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The event starts at 8 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
That's the end of another Dialect show. Featured in tonight's programme was guest Mark Sumner, actor Malcolm Greaves, reports from myself, Lisa Braden, Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, Jeff Sparks' weekly diary in What's On, and the programme was presented by myself, Lisa Braden. This week, the producer was John Peters Coleman. Until next week, it's goodbye from all of us here in the Queen Square studio. Goodbye and have a good week.